Hi, I'm Tess McLund. If you're a renter, you might be tired of hearing about homeowner woes. But guess what? You could still get zapped by a foreclosure if your landlord can't make the mortgage. Maybe the bank should consider the following.
Occupied units have less crime, stay in better repair, and of course there'll be an income stream coming in.
Rental relief is on the way. Meanwhile, when students leave their second nest, that is the college life, the most sobering moment might be the day they start to pay back those student loans.
Your monthly payments of $1,600 begin immediately. Your carefree days are over.
Better resolve to pay it off. Speaking of resolutions, you have plenty of them.
I want to try to use credit unions instead of using banks, because to use a twist on LendingTree, when banks collude, the customer gets screwed.
Listener vows for 2009 and other stories coming up on Marketplace Money from American Public Media. From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, this is Marketplace Money. There's always hope in the new year that we'll get a fresh start, a do-over, if you will. Flight of fancy, that. The fallout from the financial crisis just keeps coming. The latest jaw-dropping figure shows the economy lost more than 2.5 million jobs in 08. And without an income, how do you pay for things like rent? I'm Tess Vigeland. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media.
Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, a not-for-profit financial service provider that offers products and planning tools to help their nearly 3 million members and their communities thrive. More at thrivent.com.
Of the many concerns that arise when you lose your job, keeping a roof over your head is primary. We've talked a lot about what a struggle that's been for homeowners, folks who can no longer make the mortgage, but more than 36 million people rent. And that number is growing as homeowners go into foreclosure and become renters. A housing payment is a housing payment, whether it's a mortgage or a rent check. And renters face tough questions as they decide whether, in this economy, they can still afford the place they call home. Sally Herships explains.
Lisa Hannock and her husband are in a tough spot. They love their New York City apartment, but they can't afford to stay. They also can't afford to go.
It's a catch-22 situation. You signed a lease and you can't get out of it without paying a penalty.
Even if they found a sweet deal in another apartment building, it would cost them about 10 grand to move.
First month's rent, last month's rent, a deposit, the broker fee, and then the moving costs. It's a lot of money.
The Hannocks live on Wall Street. They got a deal when prices dropped after September 11th. But a year ago, Hannock's husband was downsized. Then, 6 months later, Lisa lost her job. He found work again, but at a much lower salary. And so their rent, which once seemed reasonable, is now stretching their previously comfy budget. And this problem is all over, like in Texas.
Retail sales have been down, so my job at Target, not so great.
Emma Flocky is a grad student in Dallas with two part-time jobs. She just lost one of her 5 shifts and doesn't have any savings to dip into.
I believe in my savings account right now I have $2. We just can't put aside to save at this point.
Just covering basic bills can be a struggle for Flocky. 2 months ago, her electricity was shut off. She says coming up with a deposit for a new place is out of reach.
$400 doesn't seem like a lot in the big picture, but really, that's a lot for me right now.
Whether you're talking hundreds or thousands doesn't really matter. If you don't have it, you don't have it. So what can a renter who's stuck in over their head do? To find out, I checked in with landlord-tenant lawyer Anthony Danzica. He gave me the bad news first.
Does it matter if you're in California, if you're in New York, or Texas, or anywhere else? A lease is a contract. You are obligated to the terms of that contract.
But there's good news, too. If you break a lease, your landlord is legally bound to try to find a new tenant.
That doesn't mean that the landlord has to take anybody he can get off the street and put him in that apartment tomorrow.
It means he has to do what's reasonable.
It could be putting in an ad in the paper or online, or he can't just leave an apartment empty and keep the damages accruing.
And if your landlord finds someone, you're off the hook. Almost. You could still get sued for the cost of re-renting, for taking out that ad or hiring a realtor. So Danzica says, before breaking your lease, try to negotiate with your landlord. And he should know. Not only is Danzica a lawyer, he also manages properties. He says if you don't have the money, the landlord will want you to go.
It's not in his interest to keep a tenant on the premises that can't pay the rent.
All across the country, people are dipping into savings to help make ends meet. Back in Dallas, Emma Flocky says she's lucky she has a roommate to help with the bills.
How much would it be to break the lease?
400 something dollars. I mean, it depends. Like, yeah.
Yeah, it's like 400 something dollars is the penalty.
Unluckily, he's also her ex-boyfriend. Her friends and family can't believe she's willing to go to this extreme for affordable housing.
It's like, wow, how do you do that? You must be the most patient person ever. And, you know, it's like, no, not really. I mean, this is just what life has necessitated.
In these tough economic times, it's in everybody's interests to work together, no matter how messy the situation. I'm Sally Herships for Marketplace Money.
Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, a not-for-profit financial service provider that offers products and planning tools to help their nearly 3 million members and their communities thrive. More at thrivent.com. And by Thomson Reuters, a source of intelligent information to businesses and professionals around the world. Thomson Reuters, knowledge to act.
So we just heard from renters who are having a tough time with that monthly check, but thousands of renters have found themselves kicked to the curb through no fault of their own. They pay the rent in full and on time, but the landlord went into foreclosure. There aren't many legal protections for renters in that situation, but as of this weekend, there is relief, at least if your landlord's property was backed by Fannie Mae. It's called the National REO Rental Policy. But as Marketplace's Dan Gretsch tells us, it's only going to help a limited number of tenants.
Glenn Sachs sold his house at the height of the South Florida real estate boom. He then rented a South Beach bachelor pad.
The view was across the Intracoastal, Palm Island, Hibiscus Island, right to the downtown skyline, all lit up at night and in the daytime full of jet skis and boats. It really felt like home to me right away.
Sachs rented the condo from two sisters. He paid the going rate, $1,600 a month. His first sign of trouble came a few months later.
One fine day, I was notified by security downstairs that there was a woman claiming she could stop my foreclosure for a fee. So my first question naturally was, what foreclosure?
Banks are required to notify tenants at the beginning of a foreclosure proceeding, which can drag on for months. But the sisters had rented Sachs the condo after the proceeding had already begun. Sachs found out just 10 days before the hearing.
It was a feeling of absolute betrayal, followed by anger, because theoretically I could have come home and found a writ from the sheriff and had possibly as little as a day to get all of my furniture out of the place and make moving arrangements.
For decades, banks have insisted on evicting tenants in foreclosed properties. They saw renters as a liability. But Fannie Mae, the government-backed mortgage company, is pioneering a new approach. It has suspended all tenant evictions through the end of January, and it's allowing tenants to rent the property even after Fannie takes over.
This is just the right thing to do.
Jason Allnut is a vice president at Fannie Mae.
You have a family who is networked into the neighborhood, into the school system, into the job market, and it's very, very difficult to be wrenched out of that network and put on the street to look for a new place to live.
This new policy of no tenant evictions only applies to properties with mortgages owned by Fannie Mae. That's less than 10% of all foreclosures. For everyone else, the old rules apply. So how do you figure out if you're a Fannie Mae renter? Allnut says foreclosure notices should include the name and phone number of the bank's attorney.
If you call that attorney and say, is this a Fannie Mae home? I will make sure that those attorneys are ready to receive those phone calls and ready to help those folks who are renters in these properties transition from that foreclosure into a new lease.
Allnut says Fannie Mae has launched a marketing campaign informing attorneys of the new policy. Eventually, he says the company will set up a hotline for renters. Allnut hopes Fannie Mae's no eviction policy will be adopted by private banks that hold the lion's share of mortgages, like JPMorgan Chase and Bank of America. Miami real estate attorney Carl Klein says Fannie Mae could lead other banks to rethink how they handle tenants.
Banks don't want to be owners. They don't want to be landlords. But I think that the Fannie Mae program
will help show banks that occupied units have less crime, stay in better repair, and of course there'll be an income stream coming in.
Glenn Sachs rented his bachelor pad long before these new protections were in place, but he was well prepared for his foreclosure drama. Sachs is a real estate attorney.
I filed an emergency motion representing myself to request that the sale be postponed just long enough so that I can move out.
He ended up moving into another unit in the same building. In Miami, I'm Dan Gretsch for Marketplace Money.
And this is Marketplace Money from American Public Media.
It's time for the audio op-ed we call The Straight Story. And with me once again this week is our economics editor, Chris Farrell. Hello, Chris.
Hello, Tess. And what's troubling you today?
You know what's really, really bugging me? I'm tired of being told that on the one hand, I should be saving all the money I possibly can as a good person. On the other hand, I should be spending all the money I can to help the greater good. The economy. What am I supposed to do?
Well, I think you passed the first test for being an economist on the one hand. On the other hand, that's really quite excellent there.
Not helpful, though.
Not helpful. All right. I agree with you. Now, here's the bottom line. You have debt. You're worried about your job. You need to save. That's the rational response. There is a discussion out there, and they're talking about, you know, the paradox of thrift from John Maynard Keynes.
Yeah, I've seen that. What does that mean?
Sounds really good. Makes you sound profound, doesn't it?
Yes, it does.
The paradox of thrift. But the paradox of thrift is actually a very simple and very powerful idea. The rational response during a downturn is to save more, spend less. But if everyone's doing it, it makes the economy worse off. It's a nice observation. That doesn't mean that you shouldn't save and borrow less. Hal Varian is a wonderful economist, University of California, Berkeley. He says, you know, this commentary that you picked up on, it's a little bit like handing someone a scotch as a cure for a hangover.
But Chris, we do hear, you know, I mean, hair of the dog. Maybe we should be out spending all this money to help the greater good.
No, because that's going to make you worse off. And in the long run, it makes the economy worse off. You know, Tess, there's so many things going on right now that we don't really understand about monetary and fiscal policy. What's the spending going to be? Maybe $1 trillion?
Yeah, something like that.
So there's a lot of activity going on to try and shore up the economy. The Fed, what do they got their rate at? 0 to 0.25% mm-hmm. on their benchmark interest rate? So a lot of stuff is going on among the elites, the monetary authorities, Congress, the White House. For you and me and households, what we can be responsible for, shore up our balance sheets, save more, because you know what? You want to do that in good times and in bad times.
And frankly, wasn't it all this excessive spending that got us into trouble in the first place?
It did. We're unwinding that. So continue the unwinding process. We don't want to go back to excessive spending.
Okay, so I can really just stop listening to all the people who are saying, oh, you know, this pullback in spending is bad. That's not my problem.
It is not your problem. You're going to solve this problem as a taxpayer.
Well, better that than racking up my credit card balance.
Absolutely.
All right. Thanks, Chris.
Thanks a lot.
What's easy to get into but hard to get out of? Bad relationships? Sure. Student loans? Definitely. A cautionary note is next on Marketplace Money from American Public Media. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. I'm Tess Miglund. Credit is tight for almost everything these days. Getting money for a house, a car, a business, even with a good credit score, it's something of a crapshoot. Student loans are the one bright spot. You can still get them, and they're usually considered a smart investment in future earnings. But with the economy in turmoil, default rates are up. Student lender Sally May says 9.4% of borrowers fell behind on payments in the third quarter last year. So college students should think very carefully about how much debt they take on. Susan Goodman reports from Annapolis, Maryland.
Many students don't realize just how much it costs to pay off a loan over time with interest. Take Meredith Lathbury. 10 years ago, she borrowed $90,000 for law school.
In fact, I was just calculating how much I've actually paid so far, and it's about $86,000 that I've paid. However, my loan is for a term of 30 years.
Which means she'll be almost 60 years old when she makes the final payment. Lathbury currently works as a lawyer for a conservation group on the Chesapeake Bay. She doesn't regret her decision to work for a nonprofit, but didn't realize how deeply her loan would affect her life.
You have this huge monthly expense that you cannot miss. But then they say it's good debt because it's student loans, and, well, doesn't feel that good, frankly.
Two-thirds of college students do take out loans and graduate with an average debt of $20,000. But is this good debt? Janet Bodner of Kiplinger's Magazine says that depends. Bodner advises doing the math before taking out a loan.
There's some really neat calculators online that you can use. You can plug in what you expect your starting salary to be based on the field that you want to go into. And you can say, gee, you know, wow, you know, that's really too much. I'm not going to be able to pay back the loans.
An affordable payment, Bodner says, is about 8% of your income.
It seems like people can really handle that. But once it goes up from that, it might be a little bit difficult.
But difficult could become impossible, given the current economy. Robert Shireman is with the Project on Student Debt.
Someone, for example, who 6 months ago decided I should train to be an investment banker and get a job at Lehman Brothers, today would probably discover that the money they put into that education, they may have trouble repaying that loan right now.
That may come as a rude awakening for some, as heard on this YouTube spoof.
Hello.
This is an automated reminder from your student loan company. Your monthly payments of $1,600 begin immediately. Your carefree days are over.
And unlike some other types of debt, student loans can't be erased in bankruptcy court, which means repaying them is as certain as death and taxes. From Annapolis, Maryland, I'm Susan Goodman for Marketplace Money.
Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, a not-for-profit financial service provider that offers products and planning tools to help their nearly 3 million members and their communities thrive. More at thrivent.com. Marketplace Money is supported by saveandinvest.org, helping military service members and families manage their money with confidence by providing unbiased financial information, tools, and more. Online at saveandinvest.org.
It's no wonder students are carrying huge debt loads after they graduate. The College Board says the average price of 4 years at a private university is more than $25,000, tuition alone. At a four-year public school, it's $6,500. But the cost of college starts even before the acceptance letters start arriving in the mail. All those essays you write come with a price tag as well, the application fee. Danielle Carson reports that with competition growing for spots on campus, students are paying multiple times just for the privilege of asking to get in.
The sticker price of a college degree has more than doubled in the last 20 years. Application fees, on the other hand, which run between $50 and $70 a pop, have been fairly steady in the last few years. But high schoolers are shelling out plenty as they apply in record numbers to at least half a dozen schools to see where they can get the best deal and education.
The whole college application process has just become so ridiculously competitive.
Shannon Gundy heads the admissions office at the University of Maryland, the state's flagship college. The school's $55 application fee is relatively modest. As a result, Gundy says more than 28,000 kids applied this year, 4,000 more than in 2007. And if the fee is still too pricey, no worries.
In those cases, we're always very willing to work with students to waive the application fee if it really is a matter of affordability, because we don't want that to be the reason that students choose not to apply.
About 12% of the applicants asked for waivers this year. Nationwide, applications at four-year colleges went up by more than 750,000 between 2004 and last year. And the internet encourages that. Dan Hurley is with the American Association of State Colleges and Universities.
10 years ago, it took some work with pen and paper or a typewriter to fill out an application. Nowadays, a high school student can get online and send out multiple applications in a very short amount of time.
College-bound students know the numbers. A lot more of their peers are applying than there are openings, so they crank out those applications. But the University of Maryland's Shannon Gundy says that's not always the best strategy.
One of the things that I try to encourage them to do is be realistic about where they think they can afford to go to college, but not to let that be the deterring factor. Students really need to look at colleges that are appropriate for them and apply for financial aid.
Javier Montenegro graduated from the University of Maryland this year and now works as an admissions counselor. He says students can find a way to cover the cost of applying to several schools by researching which ones give aid to apply.
I feel like if students are informed, they can take advantage of them and apply to as many schools as they really want to kind of keep their options open.
Colleges want to keep those applications flowing. Richard Vetter is with the Center for College Affordability and Productivity. He says every year schools brace themselves for the well-known U.S. News and World Report rankings of the best schools.
The one thing that has kept application fees from going through the roof is the schools want to be able to brag that they have lots of applicants. That looks good in these college rankings that go out if you can say, well, we had a huge number of applicants, but we only accepted a smaller percentage of that.
The University of Maryland, for example, rejected 60% of this year's applicants. But Vetter says the golden days of an ever-growing student population are over. If tuition costs keep going up, he expects the number of applicants will decline. That will leave colleges with some hard decisions about how to revamp their admissions policies to compete for new students. In Washington, I'm Danielle Carson for Marketplace Money.
It is time for Getting Personal, where we take our cue from you and go through your questions for us. With me once again is our economics editor, Chris Farrell. Hello again, Chris.
Hello again, Tess.
So first we have a sort of ethics question for you on money here. You ready for an ethics challenge?
Oh, absolutely.
All right. Well, Laura from Indianapolis recently purchased plane tickets on a credit card. Then she had to return them. The airline refunded her the cost of the tickets twice. So she called and they said there is no record of this mistake. Should she worry about them taking the money back out of her credit card later on when they do discover the mistake? Or should she just, you know, count on it never coming to light and spend this windfall without worrying?
All right. On the ethical side, I'm really glad that she contacted the airline and said, look, you made a mistake. You know, let's make this right. So she did the ethical thing. Mm-hmm. Now, on a practical level, I haven't been in exactly this circumstance. I don't know if you have, tests where there's been a mistake. Eventually, they call you. I've had something similar with my bank, and I called them, and we talked, and I filled out a piece of paper, and nothing happened. And I think it was maybe 2 months later, they contacted me and said, you know about this? And I went, yes, I know about this. I've been waiting for this call. They probably will say, oops, we need to get the money back. That's what I would guess, but she did the ethical thing. But at some point, I would expect that they will try to correct their mistake.
So what should she do, given that this is basically a rebate onto her credit card? Should she just leave whatever that amount was on the card or somehow put it in savings or something? I don't know. How does that work?
They'll contact her and they'll say, you know, we double billed you. We'd like you to write us a check. Make it good. You know, we overpaid you. And I wouldn't be surprised if at some point they'd get in touch with her. But I also wouldn't be surprised if the airline doesn't decide, you know, it's probably not even worth it. And it's just the cost of doing business. So you did the ethical thing. Relax. But don't be surprised if they do get in touch with you.
So go ahead and use that extra money on the credit card. But know that eventually you may have to send a check or have that taken back out of your card.
Exactly.
And one quick email from Nicholas in the Bronx. I can't do the New York accent. The Bronx, is that right?
I think you can move on now, yes.
He writes, quote, I'm done with Sprint. He says he does not like their customer care or their phones. He wants to cancel his contract and pay the $200 early termination fee to be rid of them.
Right.
But he's wondering how this might affect his credit score. And if it does, is it worth staying for another couple of years to prevent any penalty. I don't think this affects his credit score, right?
No, he's lived up to the terms of the agreement. He's paying the penalty to get out early. He's met his obligation. He's met his debt. No, absolutely no implications for his credit score. He sounds very frustrated. Sounds like, you know, this might be good for his health and his stress level to get out of it, and it will not do any damage to his credit report or his credit score.
The only way it could damage is if he didn't pay his bill, right?
That's right. Then you get dinged.
All right. Well, next we have Marcia on the phone from Cohoes, New York, and she's looking at some choppy waters as she decides whether to retire on her boat. Hi, Marcia.
Hi.
What kind of boat do you have?
I have a Pearson 26. It's a 26-foot long sailboat. It's a fairly average size boat, and I like it as a size for one person to take care of.
So I understand you're thinking of spending a whole lot more time at sea for retirement. Is that right?
Well, that would be ideal, yes.
Oh, it sounds lovely. But what's your question for Chris then?
Well, the challenge is I have done a number of very interesting things in my life, but not all of them have been terribly financially remunerative. So I'm looking at, you know, having a somewhat limited income when I retire. And if I want to continue to keep the boat and the car and stuff like that, I'm probably going to need to continue to work at least part-time. And so that was kind of what I was thinking about and trying to think how I could arrange that so that I could have time to sail. And then it occurred to me that if I could figure out a way to reduce my expenses, maybe I could put my stuff in storage and not have an apartment for a couple of years and just sail the boat instead.
Hmm.
You know, I know that finances are not what I do best. Are there things that I'm overlooking in this equation?
Oh, I have a couple of reactions because I think it's a wonderful dream. And so how do we make this happen? Have you lived on the boat for any lengthy period of time?
Well, actually, I have. I lived aboard for a year and a half in Boston when I was working there.
And do you like it?
I love it.
Okay. So part of what I'm wondering is doing a little experimentation.
Okay.
You sort of explore what might be some of the part-time options. Maybe you can work for a couple of months and then take a couple of months off and then come back. And, you know, you'll give up your apartment, but perhaps you have a friend that you could rent a room from. So when you're back in town for a period of time, you have a place to go to. Lots of people wouldn't mind having someone pay for a room, helps out on the mortgage, but it gives you a little bit of security, but you're not paying all that rent for an apartment.
Yeah, that's a great idea. I hadn't thought about that, and I think that is a possibility.
And then you can also see when you're on at sea, and depending on where you're going, are there opportunities for you to do some part-time work as you travel? And doing this is sort of not as a either-or, and then sort of feel it out this way, how the finances are working for you.
Well, that sounds like a good idea, yeah.
How close are you to retirement?
About 4 years away.
Okay, so you've got a little time to make this decision.
Exactly. I'm trying to plan ahead for once.
Excellent. Well done.
That's 4 years. That's a good length of time to plan.
Well, good luck, and let us know what you decide.
Okay, I will do that.
Thanks for the call.
Thank you.
Chris, I know you had your days in the Merchant Marine. Any interest in sailing around the world to give financial advice?
In a big boat, yes, because when I was in the Merchant Marine, these were oil tankers, container ships, and, you know, maybe a cruise ship around the world teaching a little personal finance. I could probably go with that. 26-foot sailboat, probably a little small for me.
All right. Well, if you do that cruise, I'll sign up for that one. Well, we are landlocked for now and always ready to answer your questions. You can call us at 877-ASK-MONEY. That's 877-275-6669. Or write us an email. You can find the Getting Personal link at marketplace.org. And we'll be back later in the show with more Getting Personal. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. Ready for a little good news? Well, according to a report released by the Commerce Department this week, for the month of November, spending on U.S. construction projects held up better than expected. There were more roads built, hotels, and office buildings. But what does that mean for the economy? For some people, it means they'll still be able to make an honest living. On this week's A Day in the Work Life, we'll meet someone who's especially relieved that there is still a place to hang her hard hat.
My name is Olga Aguilar. and I'm a union carpenter in New York City. Carpenters do all kind of work, but specifically for me, I'm working on new condominiums, so new buildings. Laying out the building, framing it to sheetrocking it, and down to the details such as cabinets and all that stuff. Right now, I'm a third-year apprentice. I have one more year to complete the apprenticeship. When I first started, it wouldn't be odd to see one or two women, or maybe perhaps be the only woman at a job site. Maybe there's some hesitation because of the stereotypes. But a lot of the women that work with me, they are mothers. They're single mothers, some of them. Some of them are grandmothers. You know, the numbers are not great, but definitely they exist. My first day was a very cold day in November, about almost 4 years ago. What I first thought was, what did I get myself into? The extreme weather, you know, doing like a dirty job. But after a while, like, the camaraderie between people gets you through the day. And, you know, you also know you're getting paid very well. Our starting rate for a first-year apprentice is, I would say, something about $30, $32 an hour to start. Every year from there, you get a raise, and that is around, I think, about $42 an hour. So it's, I would say, a pretty good living.
Sandy, where are you?
I love working with my hands. I love to see a building go up from nothing to a finished product. It's pretty amazing. The challenges, well, it's labor. It's hard on your body. We have a saying, you want to go home just the way you came in, you know, with everything intact. Smoking is definitely prohibited in all buildings. No drinking, no harassing people. I mean, I think that we do get a bad rap, but I think it's definitely an industry that has changed. It's changing within. At the end of the day, everybody respects a good work ethic. You know, it doesn't matter if you're a man or a woman. I think that's what everybody will always, always look at and respect at the end.
That was Olga Aguilar, a union carpenter in New York. If you'd like to learn more about her and her job, check out our website, marketplace.org. A Day in the Work Life was reported by Bess Kargman. How are you planning to face financial challenges this year? Well, some people are dusting off old tricks to keep their cash in check.
I'm going to go back to an old technique that I call acting poor. Think very carefully about spending money, and I try to save it in small increments.
Listener resolutions tried, true, and new. Coming up on Marketplace Money from American Public Media. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. I'm Tessa Vicklund. If you're 70 and a half years old or older, you may have had to grit your teeth as you took the mandatory withdrawal from your 401k or IRA last year. But there is help for 2009. And here to explain is John Battaglia. He's a tax advisor with Deloitte. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Remind us, first of all, 70 and a half, you have to start taking money out of your retirement funds, your 401ks, your IRAs. Why is that?
Well, it's a rule that's been around for a while, and it's just so that people eventually have to pay tax on the money that they accumulated. And this applies to a traditional IRA. Simplified employee pensions, 401ks, money purchase and profit sharing plans. It would not apply to a Roth IRA.
So now the rules have changed. Can you briefly tell us why that is?
Well, originally, everybody thought that they were going to allow people to defer the 2008 minimum distribution because of what happened with the economy and the stock market, that the values were very low. But the minimum distribution is calculated based on your balance as of the previous year, which for 2008 would be 12/31/07, when the values are a lot higher. So people would be taking out a lot more money in proportion to what's in their account. But that didn't happen. And it happens for 2009, meaning that if you have to take out a minimum distribution in 2009, you could defer it until 2010. Now, one thing that's confusing is if you turn 70 and a half in 2008. And the first year you turn 70 and a half, you can actually, for that first year, defer your minimum distribution to April 1st, 2009. But if you deferred your 2008 distribution to April 1st, 2009, you still have to take it out because that's your 2008 distribution.
And let me just complicate this a little more. What if you actually turn 70 and a half this year?
Right. If you turn 70 and a half right now, let's say you turn 70 and a half in 2009, your first distribution will be taken out in 2010 and would have to be taken out by 12/31/2010.
So what's the main question to ask as you're deciding whether to withdraw or not?
And I guess you have to ask, do I need the money? Do I need to take out a minimum distribution? And really what they need to look at is, let's say, how much money do they have outside of their retirement plans? Could they use that money for 2009 and defer the distribution? Because it is a benefit in terms of if the market rebounds to allow the money to be there to grow rather than take it out and pay tax on it.
Okay, and again, this is really a question for anyone who doesn't feel like they have to take these distributions.
Right, you really need to look at it. You know, another thing that people need to be aware of is a lot of people use their minimum distributions and have money withheld from them even more than they need to be withheld for that specific distribution in order to cover their taxes on all their income. They got to be aware if you're going to defer that 2009 distribution, you have to then pay taxes in another way. So, you know, keep that in mind.
Good advice. All right, John Battaglia is a tax advisor for Deloitte. Thanks so much for talking us through this.
You're very welcome. Thank you for having me.
Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, a not-for-profit financial service provider that offers products and planning tools to help their nearly 3 million members and their communities thrive. More at thrivent.com.
If you haven't heard about the digital TV transition, then you probably don't watch much TV. Public service announcements for the February switchover have been on the air for months, including warnings that your analog TV is about to get neutered.
Bob Barker reminding you, in February 2009, everything will be broadcast digitally, even game shows.
Lo ha cambiado del servicio básico al servicio digital.
I can't believe you gave away your old TV. February 17th, my old TV isn't going to work anymore. Anyways, dude, all you needed to do is get a digital converter. You can even get coupons.
Dude, maybe not the highest quality ads ever produced, but the message is clear. Act now or no TV for you. We've asked Sean Kapton, senior technology editor at Popular Science, to fill us in on how the change from analog to digital is shaping up and what it might cost you. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
So the conversion is a little over a month away. When people turn on their TVs on February 17th, who is not going to be happy about what they see?
Well, if you just have an analog television and an antenna, you're not getting cable or satellite. All you're able to pick up is a kind of signal that no longer is going to be transmitted, which is an analog TV signal, because starting on that date, with a few very small exceptions, everything broadcast is going to be in digital format, and old TVs, you know, were designed before that format existed, so they won't be able to read it.
So if you are one of those people, what will the screen actually look like? Is it going to be bug races or black or what?
You'll get snow, most likely, on an analog TV. There's another glitch as well that's worth mentioning. You might have an analog converter box, which is great, but if you don't have a strong enough antenna or you're not close enough to a broadcaster, you might not get a signal anyway. And the best way to tell that is if you look at your TV currently and you get a nice crisp picture, you'll probably be fine. But if you're getting the snow, the sort of double images, the ghosting, the erratic lines, it means you have a pretty weak analog signal, and it's possible it might be so weak that the digital signal won't come in at all.
Now, the government set up a voucher program more than a year ago. Remind us how that voucher system works.
Sure. And the vouchers are to purchase converter boxes. They're digital receivers that then take the signal and convert it to analog that an old TV can understand. They sell for about $60. Some are as low as maybe $40, $45. And the vouchers are a $40 voucher. You can get two per household that you can apply to the cost of that.
And how is that system working so far?
Not perfect. First of all, it takes quite a while to get one. It's about 6 weeks to get your voucher. So actually, at this point, if you haven't gotten a voucher yet, you might be waiting a little while after the transition to get it. And on top of that, the fund is running out. They allocated about $1.34 billion for it, and they're almost out of money on that one. So there's a possibility, even if you apply now, you could be waiting a while.
How many people out there are still using televisions with rabbit ears?
That's a hard number to figure out. Estimates that I've seen are about 20 million households, their only TV or all of their TVs are just analog. And then I've seen estimates about 15 million people may have cable, say, in the living room, but they have just an antenna TV maybe in the kitchen or bedroom or in the garage.
Well, I know one of those is one of our producers here at Marketplace Money. She's got a television with rabbit ears. And, you know, she was saying she's probably going to just skip this thing altogether. She doesn't pay for cable. She's not getting a converter box because she watches TV on the internet.
Exactly. I mean, if you have a computer and you have internet access, you sort of have digital TV already. All the networks offer most of their programming for free. Netflix, for example, if you have Netflix, you can watch online for free. You can download stuff from Apple iTunes. There's a lot of sources. And then there's some of the less than legal sources as well, which give you access to everything.
Right. And I'll assume that our producer does not take advantage of any of those, of course.
Of course not.
All right. Sean Kapton is Senior Technology Editor at Popular Science Magazine. Thanks so much for your help today.
Sure. Thank you.
By the way, President-elect Barack Obama this week urged Congress to postpone the February 17th switch date. Stay tuned while you still can. We are back with more Getting Personal, and Chris Farrell is with me once again to answer your personal finance questions. And first, we have Betty on the phone. She is in Lawton, Oklahoma, and has some overseas investments that she'd like to discuss. Hello, Betty.
Hi.
So what kind of overseas investments are we talking about?
Well, I bought Iraqi dinars last March in the hope that they're going to increase in value.
What prompted you to buy the Iraqi currency?
I was discussing it with some friends, and we knew that the Iraqi dinars were devalued. I mean, they're just practically worthless, and therefore you can buy them pretty cheap right now. But I did some research on the internet and saw that 4 years ago, last June, they were valued at $3.64. So I'm hoping that they go back up to $3.64 and I can cash mine in.
Well, Chris, I think, first of all, I'm guessing that you're going to say you would never recommend anyone buy a currency like this.
That is true. Absolutely. But we have the currency.
So what are the chances here? I mean, I suppose we're asking you to look into a crystal ball, but what are the chances of it being revalued at a point where she can make some money off of it?
There's some good things going on with Iraq that would suggest they will support the dinar. So it is up slightly, at least last year was up slightly against the dollar. And the Iraq war situation is improving. So those would be areas that would be supporting the dinar's value. On the other hand, it's extremely vulnerable to a decline in the price of oil. There's a big concern about that. Inflation is still running high. It's down from where it was several years ago. I believe the last number I looked at, it's running around 12%, but that's still a very high rate of inflation. So you put your investment in, I would follow it. If you can get out at some point because there's a little speculation going on, that's what I would do.
Okay. Okay.
Chris, I think maybe one of the lessons here is that, you know, all of the things that you just ticked off that you're watching, those are things that you need to be following and be aware of and understand before you make any sort of investment like this.
That's right.
Who is responsible for revaluing the dinar?
It would be the Iraqi Central Bank. And just like our Federal Reserve, so it would be the Iraqi Central Bank in cooperation or in coordination, really, I guess coordination is the more accurate term, with the Iraqi central government.
Okay. Well, thank you very much.
Thanks for the call. Well, Chris, next we have another listener with some food for thought. Cheryl is in Boulder, Colorado, and she wrote us because she and her husband have some very different responses to what's happening in the economy.
Okay.
She says her husband has been reading a lot of websites predicting a total collapse of the entire world economy. And as a result, he wants to sell everything and buy a farm somewhere. This, to put it mildly, does not coincide with her dreams.
Okay.
So as a compromise, they are refinancing their house and taking out enough equity to pay off a rental property that's big enough for the whole family to live in should the worst happen.
Right.
How do you know when a response to a crisis like this is too extreme?
Well, people are afraid. And one of my reactions is I think their compromise is pretty good. They refinanced their house and they took out enough equity to what? To pay off the rental property. So my assumption is they're probably out of debt except for their mortgage. It's not a bad situation to be in. Look rationally at your own balance sheet. How at risk are you really to a downturn in the economy? And my guess is most people, they're not as bad as they think they are. We're more fearful than our actual financial circumstances would warrant.
What do you think, though, about kind of all these prognosticators who are coming out and saying, you know what, it's going to get even worse this year. We're going to see, you know, double-digit unemployment. It really is hard to sift through some of that. And then, of course, on the other side, there are people who are saying that we've bottomed out on the stock market. How do you balance all of those seemingly random predictions?
They don't have a clue. These are reasonable guesses. They have arguments, but they don't really know what's going to happen. It is stunning that even optimists like myself will put a 10% probability that we fall into a Great Depression.
Chris, that scares me.
Now, I don't think we're going to a Great Depression. I really don't. I think that what the government here is doing, what governments overseas are doing, what the central banks are doing, is going to stave off a Great Depression. I don't think it's going to happen. But we are in a world where you have to give it some low level of probability. And you do not want to believe those who are saying it's the apocalypse, nor do you want to believe those who are saying the sun is going to shine tomorrow.
I suppose balance or moderation in all things.
Aristotle was the great financial planner. Aristotle knew what he was talking about.
Okay. Well, that's all the time we've got for questions this week, but you can ask us for advice anytime. Give us a call. We're at 877-275-6669. That's 877-ASK-MONEY. Leave a message there. Or you can send us an email. You can do that with the Getting Personal link at marketplace.org. Chris, thanks as always for the great advice.
Thanks a lot.
This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. Last week, Chris and I put all the cards on the table, including Chris's very messy office table, as we told the world our financial resolutions for 2009. We asked you to share as well, and here's a sampling of what you resolved for the new year.
My name is Jim Davis. I live in Charleston, South Carolina. My main resolution is to not allow other people's panic to drive me out of the market. I'm going to keep investing and reminding myself to buy low and sell high.
My name is Barbara Weber, and I live in Shorewood, Wisconsin. My New Year's resolution is that I'm going to go back to an old technique that I call acting poor. What this means is that I think very carefully about spending money, and I try to save it in small increments. When I do go to stores, I say out loud to myself, I don't need this. I don't need this.
My name is Jack Duderman. I'm from Jamestown, North Carolina. Well, my financial resolution for 2009 is to be a whole lot more conservative than I normally am. I consider myself to be a risk taker, but in this financial climate, I'm going to back off from taking risks and just sit back and wait. Basically, because I don't believe that anybody really knows what's going to happen. There's just too many variables at play here.
I'm Julie Larson in Tucson, Arizona. I'm basically trying to keep my spending in check. I'm going to be buying fewer clothes, less music. The reason I'm keeping a close eye on my finances is because I'm being laid off at the end of February. My job is being moved to New Zealand. I'm going to be starting a new career or possibly going back to school, and I want to make sure I have my spending in check, even though I'm getting a severance package.
My name is Chris Atrom, and I live in Houston, Texas. I have several financial resolutions for 2009. The first one is save, save. The next one is cash only, cash only. The next one is I want to try to use credit unions instead of using banks, because to use a twist on LendingTree, when banks collude, the customer gets screwed.
Some of our listeners with their financial resolutions for 09. And now, imagine me in a top hat with my index finger pointed straight ahead. Marketplace Money wants you, members of the armed forces. In a few weeks, we'll be dedicating the entire hour to personal finance issues facing active duty soldiers, reservists, veterans, their families. To send us your questions and stories about managing your money in the military, go to marketplace.org and click on Getting Personal. And that's Marketplace Money for this week. Next time, when tragedy hits a family, sometimes it's the little things that help.
What they're basically looking for is honesty. An answer. What happened?
Marketplace Money's producers include Stephen Hoffman and Eve Troh. Our theme was composed by Mark Governor. The executive producer of the program is J.J. Yore. Remember, talk to your own expert before you make any big money decisions. I'm Tess Vigeland. We'll see you next week.
Want to hear something on Marketplace Money again? Help is as near as your home computer. To find audio archives of past programs and information on transcripts, just go to the internet and log on to our website. The information you need when you need it is only a few clicks away. Just point your browser to marketplace.org. Marketplace Money is supported by Thrive and Financial for Lutherans, a not-for-profit financial service provider that offers products and planning tools to help their nearly 3 million members and their communities thrive. More at thriveint.com.
American Public Media.